On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The political winds are shifting in Lebanon.
I really hope that Lebanon now takes this opportunity and tries to rebuild itself, tries to build a real country where the Lebanese have a chance on living normal lives.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Today, a somber anniversary shows how much has already changed. And in South Korea, women are speaking out despite a movement to silence them.
You know, we're talking about a climate where to even say anything about women facing discrimination is somehow a violence against men's rights.
And how the Jewish community in Australia is responding to anti-Semitic hate.
I don't really know what to tell my son.
Plus, what dancing baby sea turtles reveal about migration.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. We start today in South Korea, where impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol's political future hangs in the balance. A constitutional court decides whether to formally remove him from office. Yoon's initial rise to power was based in part on his vocal opposition to feminism.
During his 2022 campaign, Yoon promised to shut down the Ministry of Gender Equality. He blamed the country's low birth rate on feminist ideology, and he won the support of many young conservative men. But 3 years later, South Korean women are mobilizing. The World's Matthew Bell brings us the story from Seoul.
Yoon Suk-yeol's disastrous attempt to impose martial law in early December sparked an instant reaction from the public. Many South Koreans saw it as an anti-democratic power grab. Women have played a big role in the near daily demonstrations against Yoon. I met Park Yoon-sol at a recent rally in Seoul. She's bundled up in a puffy jacket and hood to stay warm. Park says she was shocked when Yoon declared martial law. I don't know about politics, she tells me, but I could not live with the idea of my daughter growing up in this kind of country. Park says she's been out protesting almost every day. During his 2+ years in office, President Yoon failed to close the Ministry of Gender Equality because the political opposition stopped him, though he effectively hobbled the ministry by refusing to appoint anyone to lead it. He also did things like remove the term gender equality from new textbooks and, some say, helped encourage a backlash against anyone who even suggests they might be a feminist. A young video game developer is showing me a promotional video she helped create for a popular game called MapleStory. After she posted it on Twitter, someone dug up an old tweet of hers where she professes to be a feminist. That's when the online abuse began, emanating from male-dominated gaming sites, and it got much worse when someone took a screen grab from that video showing the game's main character holding up her thumb and forefinger close together. That's a gesture that anti-feminists in South Korea say is meant to mock the size of men's penises. The developer doesn't want to give me her name because the abuse she faced was so vile. When I ask my colleague and interpreter Suk-yong Lee to read some of those threats, here's part of her reaction.
I've never seen that kind of language in my 50-year life at all in South Korea. That's a totally, oh my God, it's hard to translate.
In addition to the threats, the game developer says her photo and mobile number were posted online. The game company also took that video down. Now she's got a lawyer, and she's suing dozens of men who threatened her online.
The kinds of violence that this one woman experienced is certainly not unique.
Ju Hui Judy Han teaches gender studies at UCLA.
This is widespread. There's a lot of, you know, vicious online harassments and even physical violences and backlash that take place, which is all the more reason that the dismantling of the Ministry of Gender Equality was a slap in the face for women who continue to actually face violence and to try to find some way for the state, for the government to address these issues.
Han says it's hard to wrap your head around what women in South Korea are facing and that the current president has only made things worse.
You know, we're talking about a climate where to even say anything about women facing discrimination is somehow a violence against men's rights. Like, that's the politically skewed and volatile context that Yoon helped create.
Judy Han says it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone to see women at the forefront of the ongoing protests calling for Yoon to be removed from office. After all, she says, they've been part of past political movements in South Korea. At a recent demonstration in the center of Seoul, I meet Esther Kim. She's part of a group of mostly young, self-described feminists. They're holding up purple signs that say, Yoon out, end sexual violence. Kim says she took part in the demonstrations that led to the ouster of South Korea's previous president in 2017. But this moment, she says, feels different.
We realized that impeaching a president and removing and replacing a president wasn't really going to give us a world without gender discrimination just naturally. And we decided that, oh, this time we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep the struggle, go to the streets and talk about and make that world where the gender equality is there.
Kim goes on to say that democracy without women's rights is not a real democracy at all. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell, Seoul.
20 years ago today, Rafik Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, was assassinated. He was killed by a suicide truck bomb in Beirut. It was later linked to Hezbollah. His son, Saad Hariri, became prime minister after his father's death, but quit politics in 2022, citing threats on his life for criticizing Iran, Hezbollah's patron. But much has changed since then, and today Saad Hariri was back in Beirut. He gave a speech to a huge crowd. Lebanon, which has been near the center of many crises in the Middle East, is in a new place now. Ahmad Mudalali was Rafik Hariri's foreign policy advisor. She joined us from the Munich Security Conference today in Germany.
Mr. Hariri was larger-than-life presence in Lebanon and actually in the region. He was a great prime minister. He was a great humanitarian. You know, he put 33,000 students in college. He rebuilt Lebanon physically. He rebuilt Lebanon as a reputational country in the world, its foreign policy, its relationship in the Arab world and the world at large. So what he did for Lebanon was a miracle when he was in power between 1992 and the time he was killed. So when he was assassinated, the whole country discovered how essential and how important his presence was in the country. And everybody stood up and everybody rose, not only to condemn what happened, but also to show how much they cared about him and about his vision and how much loss Lebanon had. His killing left a huge void in Lebanon.
Hezbollah was found responsible for Hariri's assassination. They're weakened now. Bashar al-Assad, who held its own sway over Lebanon, has fallen. The Israeli military is withdrawing from southern Lebanon. Is this a special time in Lebanon's political history?
It is an important time in Lebanon's history. My only worry is that I hope, actually, Lebanon does not miss this opportunity again, because this happened once before, a couple of times. Lebanon has opportunities to stand on its feet and to recover from all its problems. So I really hope that Lebanon now takes this opportunity and tries to rebuild itself, build a real country where the Lebanese have a chance on living normal life, where people love to go, people love to deal with, and people are proud of.
What is your impression of how Lebanese people are feeling right now, given this important anniversary of the death of Rafik Hariri and the return of Saad Hariri to Lebanon?
Yeah, I mean, you saw how euphoria in the streets in Beirut today because of the return of Saad Hariri, you know. So it was a very big moment for the Lebanese because they, you know, they like him. They respected the leadership and what he represents and what kind of history his family has in Lebanon. So I hope that he comes back for good and we go back to optimism.
Before the war between Hezbollah and Israel, which destroyed parts of Lebanon, there was already an economic crisis. What does Lebanon need to do to find its footing again?
Lebanon needs reforms, huge reforms. It needs reforms in every sector. Lebanon has to find a role for itself again in the region because Lebanon, for the last 20 years after Rafik Hariri died, Lebanon has lost its way. People don't know anymore in the region and in the world. What does Lebanon represent now? We have to go back to, you know, defining Lebanon's role as an amazing meeting place in the region, as a place where it's a center for culture, is a place for coexistence in the region, and a place of hope and positivity in the region.
You worked with Rafik Hariri and his administration. When you think of the time you spent with him, what comes to mind?
And success. I mean, whatever he did, succeeded. Lebanon was at the top of the world. Whatever he touched was magical for Lebanon. It can be done, you know. I learned from him something very important, and I use it today. I don't think that anything is impossible in my life, because I feel like everything can be done. If you put your head to it, you can do it. So that was his strength. It can be done. There were no limits. You know, the sky was no limit for him. He was like, no, it can be done. There's nothing impossible for him. And that's what I learned from him.
Amma Mudalali was Rafik Hariri's foreign policy advisor. She joined us from the Munich Security Conference in Germany. Our next story takes us to Egypt and mummies. Hollywood has managed to turn the whole idea of mummies into a stereotypical cliché.
There is a curse, which says that all persons present at the opening of a pharaoh's coffin shall die.
But that has not deterred generations of scientists seeking the actual truth about ancient Egypt, including researchers at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, who have been studying how mummified remains smell.
What we found in this study was that the nine bodies, mummified bodies, smelled quite differently.
Slovenian chemist Matija Stridic is one of the researchers who studied the quality of the air inside the ancient sarcophagi. Some of the human-shaped coffins are more than 3,000 years old. So researchers were prepared for the worst.
We were specifically worried that there might be indications of microbial degradation or microbiological degradation, but that was not the case.
Another member of the team, Professor Cecilia Bembibray, told BBC's Radio 4 how they pumped air from the sarcophagi into special balloons.
We put a very fine tube inside the sarcophagus and extracted a quantity of air that we could then smell. So this is the air that would be around the mummified body. It's called a headspace technique, and it's also used in perfumery.
Some of the scents they identified were ones you'd expect.
We use a technique called gas chromatography, which separates all the different smells in the mix of the mummified body smell. And there we were able to smell moldy compounds, for example, and stale compounds.
But there were also pleasant fragrances. Egyptian embalmers used conifer oils, frankincense, myrrh, and cinnamon, all of which were detected by the team's sniffing machines.
Bembibray says the olfactory profile of mummified bodies has never been documented like this. And far from being the mummy's curse, this research could be the mummy's gift.
This is useful for scientists and also for conservators who care for this collection, so we can ensure that it reaches future generations.
Bembibray and her team are eager to share their mummy-smelling experience with the world. They're planning to reconstruct the smells for exhibits at museums in Egypt and Slovenia.
The research is published this week in the Journal of the American Chemical Society.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. What many see as a long overdue court case has finally begun in the UK. The accused is the international oil company Shell. The Ogoni people who live in the Niger Delta of Nigeria claim that decades of oil leaks and spills by Shell and its local subsidiary have left the region with contaminated drinking water and farmlands. The oil giant sees it differently. Shell blames locals for the pollution. Diolu Tobacheku has been following the litigation. He's a climate justice advocate based in Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta. He said there are two central issues at the heart of the case against Shell.
Destruction of land and livelihood. What has been happening over the years is irresponsible drilling. In fact, from 1960, we've had over 50,000 oil spillages. Just imagine, over 50,000. Even as I'm talking to you now, in this Ogali community, there is currently an oil spill, and Shell has taken responsibility for it. I mean, if you've seen a video or a picture of an oil spillage, I mean, you see that their entire waterways will be black. In fact, you own a tap in your house and the water is black. You just imagine, right? The fishes are dead. You see the fishes floating. Recently, there was a sea wash where they had a lot of big fishes washed to the shores, fishermen. And those communities are predominantly farmers. So when their livelihood is destroyed, their waterways are destroyed, the source of income is destroyed, and then they are not gaining anything from the oil companies. It's pathetic.
Shell is officially out of the Ogoni lands. So what's the issue for the people in the Niger River Delta now?
This is a complex situation. Even though Shell is officially out, I mean, they stopped drilling from around 1993, 1994 because of the unrest. However, Shell facilities is still there. It's still operational. For example, this recent oil spillage, Shell said it's because they're trying to, it came from a sewer tank or something, right? Their facilities are still there. So the remediation process, the restoration, land restoration process has not been completed. So Shell still has, even though these facilities is largely under the federal government, but Shell facilities are still there. And a lot of them are still used for illegal activities.
So you're saying that Shell may be gone, but the facilities that they set up and ran for years are still there and operating and causing pollution and damage, even though Shell personnel are not there.
Exactly.
Now, it's interesting. Shell argues that they're not to blame. A spokesperson for Shell has said that the real problem in the Niger Delta is theft, illegal refining, and sabotage. What are they referring to?
The truth of the matter is that we have local issues. We have a lot of issues relating to oil theft. But every company is to create measures around your facilities. So is their facility, is their responsibility. And all this shifting of blame, it's not our fault, it's not, I mean, all those things are just mere marketing. Everybody knows that is their facility, is their responsibility.
So in this case, taking Shell to court, is the goal to convict Shell and have this be a really important symbolic victory that a local community has gone after them for pollution, or is it to get damages and money to clean up the area?
Of course, the damage has been done. So the victory will be remediation, which is to pay for losses and damages, to pay communities that have been affected by oil spillage over time, to pay for the destruction of lives, for the destruction of properties, for the destruction of land, for the destruction of livelihood. That's the victory.
Diolu Tobacheku is a climate justice advocate based in Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta.
Around 150,000 people have traveled to the northern Chilean town of Arica for Carnival. It is a huge celebration honoring Chile's indigenous Aymara, Quechua, and Afro-Chilean cultures. Michael Fox brings us to the heart of the festivities in Arica.
A shaman stands on the street corner of a working-class neighborhood. His hands are in the air. He's making an offering to Pachamama, Mother Earth. On the ground, herbs and coca leaves are laid out on a colorful blanket. The shaman throws incense on the flames of a small fire and pours alcohol and wine on the four cardinal points, each time asking for Mother Earth's blessing and guidance. This is a ceremony to mark the beginning of carnival for the Tobas Andino Sajama Guerreros folk dance troupe. 33-year-old Diego Maldonado is one of the leaders. He's been dancing since he was 10.
Bueno, para nosotros que somos Aymara, que llevamos ya tiempo bailando.
For those of us who are Aymara, who have been dancing for a long time and who learned this from our grandparents and from our ancestors, this is really important, he says. We learned this from the cradle. We watched our parents and our grandparents practicing these traditions before us. It's necessary and it's important. The Aymara are the second largest indigenous group in Chile. Their central homeland is in the highlands of Bolivia, but they've lived in what is now Chile and southern Peru since pre-Columbian times. As of 2015, they made up almost a third of the population of the province of Arica. This carnival is largely a celebration of Aymara indigenous identity. Paulo Noya Matos's family is from Bolivia, but he grew up here in Arica.
El carnaval vendría siendo un rescate de las descendencias bolivianas.
This carnival is like a revival of Bolivian heritage, says Noya Matos. It celebrates and validates Andean culture. It transcends borders and makes you feel part of Andean culture. Noya Matos is performing in a tarqueada dance group. They march with thick, long wooden flutes. They say their song calls for the rains this time of the year, planting time in the region. Nearly 80 different dance troupes are performing over the next 3 days. They're doing one of more than a dozen different traditional dances. Each has a different style, look, music, and significance. But they're all tied to Mother Earth and celebrating people's connection to their indigenous roots. That is no small feat in a country that pushed Chilean nationalism and assimilation throughout the 20th century. Noya Matos says that before there was a lot of discrimination against Peruvian, Bolivian, and Aymara cultures. He says he himself faced a ton of discrimination growing up for being of Bolivian descent. But times are changing. Lily Beth Diaz and Judith Mamani are dancing the Morenada, a typical folk dance originally from the Bolivian cities of La Paz and Oruro. They wear huge smiles and extravagant yellow cholita dresses. We dance with our hearts. We sing with everything we have because these are our roots, says Judith Mamani. We sing, we dance, we give everything we have in this carnival because we carry it in our blood. Afro-Chilean dance and culture has also taken center stage at the carnival. Black communities have a long history in Arica. Spanish colonizers forced African descendants to work the land here for hundreds of years. Together, all of these groups are standing up for their identities and celebrating their ancestry. For the world, I'm Michael Fox, Arica, Chile.
More stories from around the globe are headed your way. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Jewish schools spray-painted with swastikas. A synagogue firebombed. Jewish businesses torched. A wave of anti-Semitism is sweeping through Australia. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The first day of school at Mount Sinai in the suburbs of Sydney is supposed to be fun. This year, though, a few days before school was supposed to begin, someone spray-painted the building with ugly messages. Jew dogs, the graffiti said. Jewish murderers. Jews are the real terrorists. The police painted it over so children didn't have to walk past it. But Joshua says you could still see the wet paint. He's a parent at the school and didn't want to give his last name.
I don't understand why there were people that would intimidate innocent children. Children in Australia are not party or responsible for the actions of the Israeli government. We have nothing to do with it. We're just living our life according to our faith and our tradition.
Joshua says there's a visible police presence outside of the school. And there were always guards, but now there are more, plus more cameras, more foot patrols, more fencing. Of course, his seven-year-old notices.
I don't really know what to tell my son. I sort of just say, oh, there's more security around the school. That's to protect us. The police are out the front. That's to protect us. There are some bad people in the world, and we're just being careful.
Joshua says the vandalism at the school wasn't completely unexpected. The week before, a daycare center down the block was firebombed and scrawled with anti-Semitic graffiti. And then police announced they'd found an abandoned trailer on the outskirts of Sydney filled with explosives along with a list of Jewish targets. The Jewish community in Australia has been bracing itself since the Hamas terror attacks in Israel on October 7th. On October 8th in Western Sydney, a group of pro-Palestinian protesters celebrated.
I'm smiling and I'm happy. I'm elated. It's a day of courage.
The next day, the Sydney Opera House was lit up in blue and white in solidarity with Israel. Police warned the Jewish community to stay out of the area. About 1,000 people gathered on the steps.
What was meant to be a peaceful pro-Palestine demonstration, anything but. As an Israeli flag was set alight, flares thrown, and anti-Semitic slurs chanted. In front of one of Sydney's most famous landmarks.
When Israel began bombing Gaza, the attacks on the Jewish community in Australia became more serious. They included attacking Jewish homes and businesses, death threats and doxing of prominent Jewish figures, and the torching of a Melbourne synagogue, which damaged Torah scrolls inside. Australia doesn't keep a national record of hate crimes, but the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, which is a community group, reported that in the 12 months following the Hamas attacks, there was a 316% increase in anti-Semitic incidents across the country.
It's worse than ever. You can talk to anyone in the Jewish community in Australia, they will tell you it's never been so bad.
Matteo Vergani researches extremism at Deakin University in Melbourne. He says anti-Semitism usually goes up after a so-called trigger event, like a conflict in the Middle East. But this war has been going on for 15 months.
And the scale of the conflict is, of course, much larger. So the impact of this trigger event is huge.
Vergani says some of the people who were arrested for the anti-Semitic crimes identify as neo-Nazis. Others identify with pro-Palestinian groups. And in one case, he says, there was graffiti glorifying the PKK, a militant separatist group in Turkey. In other words, there's not a lot of cohesion. Political leaders have unequivocally condemned the spike in anti-Semitism. In a rare moment of unity, Australian lawmakers came together last week to toughen the punishments for hate crimes, including imposing mandatory jail time for giving a Nazi salute in public. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has declared that anti-Semitism has no place in Australia.
We have a simple message to those cowards and criminals engaged in these low acts of hatred. You will be caught. You will be punished. Our government has no tolerance for your actions.
Joshua at the Mount Sinai School says he has confidence in his elected leaders and in local law enforcement. He believes they can keep his family safe. And yes, there's fear in the community, he says, but there's also defiance.
I like to think to myself, well, what is the purpose of this? What's this intimidation trying to achieve? It's trying to disrupt our way of life, and it's not going to happen.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Loggerhead sea turtles can navigate thousands of miles, starting when they're just babies. It's long been thought that the turtles rely on the Earth's magnetic field to do that, but exactly how has remained a mystery. New research published in the journal Nature this week provides one clue. Marine biologist Kayla Goforth from Texas A&M University is the lead author.
So we previously knew that they could navigate using both what's called a magnetic map, which is like a positional sense. So that enables them to detect where they are in the world, kind of like a GPS, and that they also had a compass sense. And the compass is like a directional sense, so that enables them to maintain a specific heading. And we knew that they could use these during their initial migration as hatchling turtles when they're traveling around the Atlantic Ocean, but how they might use it later in their lives to identify feeding sites and nesting sites was unclear. So we found that turtles have the ability to learn magnetic fields, and the ability to learn magnetic fields is probably how they're identifying feeding grounds or nesting sites that they then return to continuously throughout their lives.
Can you just kind of paint a picture of what these migratory patterns look like for sea turtles, just to give us a sense of how far they are traveling?
So as hatchlings, they emerge from their nests on the east coast of the U.S., and then they'll travel over towards Europe and Africa, and then eventually back towards the Caribbean. And that takes them about 5 to 7 years. And then once they're back over in waters off the coast of the U.S., they'll take up residency in a feeding site, and they'll likely stay there, or they might move to a different feeding ground until they reach adulthood, which is at about 20 years old. And as adults, they then begin to make migrations every few years back to their nesting beaches, and they actually return to the same beach on which they were born in order to lay their own eggs.
So you showed that they can learn magnetic fields for the first time. How did you go about doing that?
So we conditioned them, or trained them, a little bit like you might train a dog. We conditioned the turtles to associate one magnetic field with food, and then they were conditioned to associate another magnetic field with nothing. So they experienced one of those two fields every other day. So on day one, they would get the field with food, and they were fed squid and shrimp, which they love. On the second day, they experienced the magnetic field without food. And this continued for 2 months, and eventually we started to see that they would exhibit what we call the turtle dance in the magnetic field they associate with food.
And can you just describe the turtle dance for listeners, because it is adorable?
Yes. So they do this behavior in captivity when they're expecting to be fed. They stick their heads up out of the water, they open their mouths, they begin to flap their flippers wildly and even spin around.
It does look like a little bit of a happy dance that they're doing.
Yeah, it does. It always reminds me of my parents' dogs that spin around when they're expecting a treat.
Right. I can picture that, too. So the idea here is that since you have proven that these turtles can learn a specific magnetic field, they might be able then to return to a place that they have been before for feeding, for example, out in the wild.
Yes, that's what we expect. And we even showed that some of our turtles could remember the magnetic field they learned for at least 4 months' time in the lab setting.
So this finding is important, I gather, not just for sea turtles, but for migratory species writ large. Tell me how applicable this might be, this idea that, you know, animals can learn a specific magnetic field.
So birds and turtles are pretty similar in that they'll return to really specific breeding grounds where they lay their eggs and reproduce. And so the fact that turtles have been shown to learn a magnetic field makes it more likely that birds also have this ability.
And it's not yet clear, though, exactly how they sense the magnetic field and its differences around the world, right? That the particular mechanism is not yet understood.
Correct. We don't know a lot about the mechanism, especially for the magnetic map sense or that GPS sense. We did show that the compass of sea turtles probably relies on a hypothesized mechanism called chemical magnetoreception. So this hypothesis just states that complex chemical reactions might give animals the ability to detect magnetic fields. And the way that you can test that, whether that's likely the case, is you expose animals to what's called a radio frequency field. And radio frequency fields are thought to interrupt those reactions, and so they would prevent animals from detecting magnetic fields. And we demonstrated that our turtles could no longer orient when radio frequency fields were present.
So you mentioned that this might be a way that sea turtles learn to be able to return to faraway places that might be, for example, good feeding sources. But, you know, this does not explain why hatchlings know where to go when they've never been there before. Is that something that is already known by science? And if so, can you tell us how?
We know that they must inherit information about magnetic fields in some manner, but exactly what they inherit, we don't know. But we know that young hatchlings will respond to magnetic fields along their initial migration pathway by swimming in directions that keep them traveling in that migration pathway, which is just around the entire Atlantic Ocean.
Kayla Goforth is with the Department of Biology at Texas A&M. Her research on sea turtle navigation was published this week in the journal Nature.
And now let's catch you up on some other animal news you might have missed.
In Indonesia, a gang of rhinoceros poachers is going to prison. The six men confessed to killing 26 Javan rhinos over a period of 5 years. They've been handed prison sentences of more than 10 years each, along with hefty fines. The Javan rhino is critically endangered. Only about 80 of them are thought to exist in the wild.
In Canada, a win for owls and scorned lovers alike. A British Columbia-based owl breeder offered a fundraising deal for Valentine's Day. In exchange for a donation, people could name dead rats after their exes. The rats were then fed to an endangered spotted owl. For about $3.50, what a steal. The fundraiser is over for this year, but if you hold on to that anger, you can name a rat after your ex next year.
And in England, a councillor for the town of Whittlebury resigned last week after being accused of trying to blow up his neighbor's cat. A video circulating online shows the cat climbing into a bird feeder in the councillor's backyard when suddenly an explosion engulfs the feeder and the cat. Miraculously, the cat survived. Just a few singed whiskers.
And that's a few animal stories you might have missed. This Sunday marks a year since the death of Alexei Navalny. The prominent Russian opposition politician was a fierce critic of Vladimir Putin. Back in 2020, he was poisoned, likely by Kremlin henchmen. After regaining his health, he returned to Russia, only to be imprisoned. 3 years later, he died in a penal colony north of the Arctic Circle. The World's Daniel Offman has this story about Navalny, his legacy, and how his organization is still functioning today.
Since Putin came to power in Russia, there's been a gradual crackdown against any form of dissent. And that process has accelerated since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Roman Dobrokhotov is the editor-in-chief of The Insider, a Russian investigative outlet based outside the country. He says the death of Navalny marked a turning point in the stripping down of rights in Russia.
This is a change of political eras in the country. Putin showed that he burns all the bridges with the West, with civil society. There will be no turning back, that he doesn't care about the consequences.
Dobrokhotov says the oppressive political environment in Russia today is even more severe than it was in the late Soviet period.
It's more like Stalin's era when the government terrorizes people by killing its opponent and showing everybody that if you try to be vocal, you will be the next. So if we can kill Navalny, that means that we can kill anyone.
Putin always saw Navalny as a threat. Someone who proved that he could organize mass protests. Dobrokhotov says that Putin's attitude towards Navalny as an internal enemy was almost superstitious.
Vladimir Putin really believed in this symbolism. For example, he never mentioned Alexei Navalny's name, so he always described him as like some politician, but he never pronounced his name out loud. So I think that he has even some maybe like semi-religious attitude, that this is something more than just a political fight.
In his first public pronouncement about Navalny, about a month after his death, Putin mentioned him by name for the first time in years. Even after his death, Navalny's organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, has been vilified by the Kremlin. They've been labeled an extremist organization, making it impossible for them to work in Russia. Ben Noble, a professor of Russian politics at University College London and the co-author of a book about Navalny, says that Navalny's colleagues remain politically active in exile.
The team have continued their investigations into elite corruption in Russia. But there, I think we have to pause a bit and ask the question, is that approach still effective?
When Navalny was alive, his organization's investigations about government corruption were a sensation. They racked up tens of millions of views on YouTube and even led to mass protests. But Roman Dobrokhotov says that these investigations don't resonate the same way they used to.
This idea of like anti-corruption investigations is a little bit outdated in the country that is already waging a war against its neighbors and also waging a war against its civil society.
Since Navalny's death, the videos that his team put out don't get as many views. Ben Noble says that there's also been a lot of infighting among the Russian political opposition in exile.
The worry now, though, is that without the charismatic singular figure of Navalny, those squabbles and those conflicts, they take up even more oxygen and make people feel disillusioned with the opposition, that they're more interested in fighting each other rather than constructing a vision for the future.
Some of Navalny's critics and supporters have questioned his decision to return to Russia. I asked Noble if he thinks it was a mistake.
Navalny felt he didn't have a choice. He considered himself to be a Russian politician who had to be in Russia in order to be effective. And the language of mistakes, I just don't think then applies. Even if some people might step back and say, maybe it was a selfish move because we no longer have that voice on which we relied so much.
Noble says that Navalny stood out among Russian politicians because of his voice, his irony, and his dark sense of humor. Nikita Kulachenkov worked for Navalny's organization for 7 years. He says that Navalny was authentic, principled, and at times stubborn.
He was like a vehicle and like person showing hope that Russia can change and be a country that we wanted it to be, and like being a Swiss, a normal country.
Kulachenkov says that right now there's a sense of demoralization among Russians who oppose Putin. In a 2022 Oscar-winning documentary, Navalny was asked to share a message in the event that he'd be killed.
My message for the situation when I am killed is very simple: not give up.
He went on to say in Russian that if they decided to kill me, it means that we are incredibly strong. We don't realize how strong we actually are. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We have one more story for you before we unleash you to your weekend. This one is about a quirky science fiction musical that got its start in South Korea before opening on Broadway to rave reviews. Jeff London reports on the surprising resonance of a musical about two robots falling in love. It's called Maybe Happy Ending.
When he was approached to work on it, director and choreographer Michael Arden says the basic premise of Maybe Happy Ending didn't appeal to him.
It's not a great elevator pitch, I'll say that. When I first received the script and read the tagline, I thought, oh no. And then by the time I was finished reading and listening to it, I was completely devastated and overcome with emotion.
The ending's not the most important part, but as endings go, ours is not so bad.
The show's authors, no Korean-born tears, Hugh no Park and American Will Aronson, began working on the show over a decade ago. Hugh Park, who has written lyrics for top 20 K-pop hits, says he was listening to a song called Everyday Robots in a Brooklyn coffee shop and got inspired.
And it starts with saying we are everyday robots on our phone in the process of getting home. And so I was like, oh, I want to see a little quiet, intimate show about who we are becoming in this digital era, but the protagonists are human-like robots.
And in this digital era, he texted his writing partner, Will Aronson, and they got to work. The pair has premiered several musicals in Korea, and Aronson speaks Korean fluently. Maybe Happy Ending is set in Seoul, where the show had a tryout production in 2015. Aronson says it's had several subsequent productions there.
Shows in Korea don't do open runs generally. They're usually 2 to 3 month runs. And then if it's going well, it'll come back a year or 2 years later. And yeah, we've been very fortunate that the audience did respond and it's come back consistently.
Even as the show became a hit in Korea, Aronson says the team had plans to do it in the States.
We did a reading of the English language script, and at that point, we paired with our current producers, and there are several new songs. We took some Korean songs out and put some new songs into this version. Mm-hmm.
The Korean version is about 15 minutes longer, but the story is basically the same. A pair of retired helper bots, humanoid servants, named Oliver and Claire, embark on a surprising romantic relationship. Darren Criss, who starred on TV's Glee, plays Oliver in the Broadway production and draws on everything from European clowning techniques to kabuki theater to silent film to create his mechanical man.
From the world within my room, I choose a book and I read it, a place to recharge when I need it, and it's all...
Helen J. Shen is making her Broadway debut as Claire. She says her character seems more human since she plays a more recent model.
I have found since opening, since previews, my portrayal of Claire has really evolved and gotten more robot-y, less robot-y, kind of seeing how going through that spectrum can help tell the story better.
It's the way that it always was. It'll be okay, it'll be okay. A robot does what she always does. It's the only way it'll be okay.
The two robots discovered they really need each other. Claire has to borrow Oliver's charger since hers is on the fritz. They eventually go on a road trip to an island off the coast of South Korea. Composer Will Aronson says sometimes the characters' emotions come out in the music that's not sung.
We knew that because they were robots, they couldn't really sing, say, power ballads, because it just would not be in character. It would break the world of the show. But of course, we want big moments in theater, right? So if you'll notice in the show, it has several big musical sequences that have no dialogue, that are purely staging and music.
Like a magical moment where Claire and Oliver see fireflies, which they call tiny robots. And despite themselves, they fall in love.
You're part instead of whole when you're in love. You are the loneliest.
Co-author Hugh Park says writing Maybe Happy Ending was a self-meditative journey. He started it after breaking up from a long-term relationship, losing a close friend to cancer, and turning 30.
It was around the time in my life I was sort of like growing up or coming out of like a certain age, and I got to think of, you know, why am I putting myself in that situation? Like, you know, signing up for really depending on my significant other, or, you know, like really sharing my life with a friend, because it's really painful when they inevitably have to end.
Turns out, like humans, robots have a shelf life. Their batteries run out, their components wear out, and after having a romantic, goofy love affair, Oliver and Claire decide to wipe their memories. Or do they?
And maybe we'll meet again somewhere, somewhere things don't have to have an ending.
Director Michael Arden.
There's nothing cynical about this piece, and I think that's key to it, that actually I think we're desperate to go to the theater to feel things that hopefully when we leave cause us to kind of make the more loving, more hopeful, more generous choice. And I have to believe that that's what's happened here.
And its authors just premiered a new musical in Seoul. Broadway musicals used to try out in Boston and Philadelphia, but perhaps the South Korean capital may be becoming a new Broadway pipeline. For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
Is this our maybe happy ending?
We'll see.
Looking ahead to Monday, as the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion approaches, we'll have a one-hour special that looks at how it started, where things stand for Ukrainians, and how Russians might look back on the war regardless of how it turns out.
Now it's part of the textbook. Now it's part of the curriculum, and it becomes part of the heroic narrative of Russia's military greatness.
Tune in for that on Monday.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Hare studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Take it easy this weekend.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Pat Castaldo, Catherine D., Jan Elizabeth, Chris Gillis, Rich Gorlick, Leanne Hahn, and Patrice F. and Cameron J. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.